The corporal has an accent from Yamaguchi, which is where most of the soldiers posted here came from. He seems more rural than urban.
Your mother and father back on the farm in Yamaguchi?
Yes.
And your brother who is in the Navy?
Yes.
And your sister who is...
A school teacher in Hiroshima, very good.
As well as your aunt who is also in Hiroshima.
And don't forget my uncle in Kure.
Oh yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Now tell me the message again, just to make sure you won't forget it.
Okay,
says Goto Dango, and draws a deep breath. He is really starting to come around now. They are trudging down to the sea. He and half a dozen others, all unarmed and carrying small bundles, accompanied by the corporal and privates. Below, in the gentle surf, a rubber boat awaits them.
We're almost there! Tell me the message! Tell it back to me!
My beloved family,
Goto Dango begins.
Very good. Perfect so far,
says the corporal.
My thoughts are with you, as always,
Goto Dango guesses. The corporal looks a bit crestfallen.
Close enough. Keep going.
They have reached the boat. The crew shoves it out into the surf a few paces. Goto Dango stops talking for a few moments as he watches the others wade out to it and climb in. Then the corporal prods him in the back. Goto Dango staggers out into the ocean. No one has started yelling at him yet. In fact, they reach for him, pulling him in. He tumbles into the bottom of the boat and clambers up to a kneeling position as the crew begins to row it out into the surf. He locks eyes with the corporal back on the beach.
This is the last message you will receive from me, for by now I have long since gone to my rest on the sacred soil of the Yasukuni Shrine.
No! No! That's totally wrong!
Hollers the corporal.
I know that you will visit me there and remember me fondly, as I remember you.
The corporal splashes into the surf, trying to chase the boat, and the privates plunge in after him and grab him by the arms. The corporal shouts,
Soon we will deal the Americans a smashing defeat, and then I will march home through the streets of Hiroshima in triumph, along with my comrades.
He recites it like a schoolboy doing his lessons.
Know that I died bravely, in a magnificent battle, and never for one moment shirked my duty.
Goto Dango shouts back.
Please send me some strong thread so that I can mend my boots.
The corporal cries.
The army has looked after us well, and we have lived the last months of our lives in such comfort and cleanliness that you would hardly guess we had ever left the home islands.
Goto Dango shouts, knowing that he must be difficult to hear now above the surf.
When the final battle came, it came quickly, and we went to our deaths in the full flower of our youth, like the cherry blossoms spoken of in the Emperor's rescript. Which we all carry against our breasts. Our departure from this world is a small price to pay for the peace and prosperity that we have brought to the people of New Guinea.
No! That's totally wrong!
Wails the corporal. But his comrades are dragging him up the beach now, back towards the jungle, where his voice is lost in an eternal cacophony of hoots, screeches, twitters, and eerie cries. Goto Dango smells diesel and stale sewage. He turns around. The stars behind them are blocked out by something long and black and shaped kind of like a submarine.
Your message is much better,
someone mumbles. It is a young fellow carrying a toolbox, an airplane mechanic who has not seen a Nipponese airplane in half a year.
Yes, says another man. Also a mechanic, apparently.
His family will find your message much more comforting.
Thank you,
Goto Dango says.
Unfortunately, I have no idea what the kid's name is.
Then go to Yamaguchi, says the first mechanic, and pick some old couple at random.
Meteor.
You sure don't fuck like a smart girl,
says Bobby Shafto, his voice suffused with awe. The wood stove glows in the corner, even though it's only September, for Christ's sakes, in Sweden, where Shafto has spent the last 6 months. Julieta is dark and lanky. She reaches one long arm far across the bed, gropes on the nightstand for a cigarette.
Could you reach that jizz rag?
Shafto says, eyeing a neatly folded United States Marine Corps handkerchief next to the cigarettes. His arm is too short.
Why?
Julieta speaks great English, like all the other Finns. Shafto sighs in exasperation and buries his face in her black hair. The Gulf of Bothnia whooshes and foams down below them, like a badly tuned radio pulling in strange information. Julieta is given to asking big questions.
I just don't want there to be a big mess when I execute my withdrawal, ma'am,
he says. He hears the flint of Julieta's lighter itching once, twice, thrice behind his ear. Then her chest pushes him up as her lungs fill with smoke.
Take your time, she purrs, her vocal cords syrupy with condensed tar. What are you going to do? Go for a swim? Invade Russia?
Somewhere out there across the Gulf is Finland. There are Russians there, and Germans.
See, even when you mention going for a swim, my dick gets smaller,
Shafto says.
So it's going to come out, inevitably.
He thinks he pronounces this last word correctly.
Then what will happen? Julieta says.
We'll get a wet spot.
So? It's natural. People have been sleeping on wet spots as long as beds have existed.
God damn it!
Shafto says, and lunges heroically for the Semper Fi handkerchief. Julieta digs her fingernails into one of the sensitive spots that she has located during her exhaustive cartographic survey of his body. He squirms to no avail. All the Finns are great athletes. He pops out. Too late. He knocks his wallet onto the floor while grabbing the hanky, then rolls off Julieta and wraps it around himself, a flag on a broken pole. The only flag of surrender Bobby Shafto will ever wave. Then he just lies there for a while, listening to the surf and the popping of the wood in the stove. Julieta rolls away from him and lies curled up on her side, avoiding the wet spot, even though it is natural, and enjoying her cigarette, even though it isn't. Julieta smells like coffee. Shafto likes to nuzzle and smell her coffee-scented flesh.
The weather is not too bad. Uncle Otto should be back before night, she says.
She is lazily regarding a map of Scandinavia. Sweden dangles like a flaccid circumcised phallus. Finland bulges scrotally underneath. Its eastern border with Russia no longer bears any resemblance to reality. This elusive frontier is furiously crosshatched with pencil marks. The axes of Stalin's repeated efforts to castrate Scandinavia, obsessively recorded and annotated by Julieta's uncle, who, like all Finns, is an expert skier, crack shot, and indomitable warrior. Still, they despise themselves. Shafto thinks it's because they eventually farmed out the defense of their country to the Germans. Finns excelled at an old-fashioned, personalized, retail style of Russian killing, but when they started to run low on Finns, they had to call in the Germans, who are more numerous and who have perfected a wholesale Russian slaughtering operation. Julieta scoffs at this simple-minded theory. Finns are a million times more complex than Bobby Shafto can ever understand. Even if the war had never happened, there would be an infinity of reasons for them to be depressed all the time. There is no point even in trying to explain it all. She can only provide him with the haziest glimpses into Finnish psychology by fucking his brains out once every couple of weeks. He has been lying there for too long. Soon the leftover jism in his tract will harden like epoxy. This peril spurs him to action. He slides out of bed, cringes from the chill, hops across cold planks to the rug, scurries instinctively toward the warmth of the stove.
Julieta rolls over onto her back to watch this. She looks at him appraisingly.
"Be a man," she says. "Make me some coffee."
Shafto snatches the cabin's cast-iron kettle, which could double as a ship anchor if need arose. He throws a blanket over his shoulders and runs outside. He stops at the brink of the seawall, knowing that the splintery pier will not be kind to his bare feet, and pisses down onto the beach. The yellow arc is veiled in steam, redolent of coffee. He squints across the gulf and sees a tug pulling a boom of logs down the coast, and a couple of sails, but not Uncle Otto's. Behind the cabin is a standpipe that is fed from a spring in the hills. Shafto fills the kettle, snatches a couple of hunks of firewood, and scampers back inside, maneuvering between stacked bricks of foiled packed Java and crates of Suomi machine pistol ammunition. He sets the kettle on the iron stove and then stokes it up with the wood.
"You use too much wood," Julieta says. "Uncle Otto will be noticing."
"I'll chop more," Shafto says. "This whole fucking country is full of nothing but wood."
"You'll be chopping wood all day if Uncle Otto gets angry at you."
"So it's okay for me to sleep with Otto's niece, but burning a couple of sticks of wood to make her coffee is grounds for dismissal?"
"Grounds," Julieta says. "Coffee grounds."
The entire country of Finland, to hear Otto tell it, has been plunged into an endless night of existential despair and suicidal depression. The usual antidotes have been exhausted. Self-flagellation with steeped birch twigs, mordant humor, week-long drinking bouts. The only thing to save Finland now is coffee. Unfortunately, the government of that country has been short-sighted enough to raise taxes and customs duties through the roof. Supposedly, it is to pay for killing Russians and for resettling the hundreds of thousands of Finns who have to pull up stakes and move whenever Stalin, in a drunken lunge, or Hitler, in a psychotic fit, attacks a map with a red Crayola. It just has the effect of making coffee harder to obtain. Finland is a nation of unproductive zombies, except in areas that have been penetrated by the distribution networks of coffee smugglers. Finns are generally strangers to the entire concept of good fortune. However, they are lucky enough to live right across the Gulf of Bothnia from a neutral, reasonably prosperous country famous for its coffee. With this background, the existence of a small Finnish colony in Norsbrook becomes pretty much self-explanatory. The only thing that is missing is muscle to load the coffee onto the boat, and to unload whatever swag Otto brings back. Needed? One muscular lunkhead willing to be paid off the record in whatever specie Otto comes up with. Sergeant Bobby Shafto, USMC, pours some beans into the grinder and starts to belabor the crank. A black flurry begins to accumulate in the coffee pot below. He has learned to make this stuff the Swedish way, using an egg to settle the grounds. Chopping wood, fucking Julieta, grinding coffee, fucking Julieta, pissing on the beach, fucking Julieta, loading and unloading Otto's catch. This has been pretty much it for Bobby Shafto during the last half year. In Sweden, he has found the calm gray-green eye of the blood hurricane that is the world. Julieta Kvistek is the central mystery. They do not have a love affair. They have a series of love affairs. At the beginning of each affair, they are not even speaking to each other. They do not even know each other. Shafto is just a drifter who loads for her uncle. At the end of each affair, they are in bed fucking. In between, there is anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks of tactical maneuver, false starts, and arduous cut-and-thrust flirtation. Other than that, each affair is completely different, like a whole new relationship between two entirely different people. It is crazy. Probably because Julieta is crazy. Much crazier than Bobby Shafto. But there's no reason for Shafto not to be crazy, here and now. He boils the coffee, does the trick with the egg, pours her a mug. This is nothing more than a courtesy. Their affair just ended, and the new one hasn't started yet. When he brings her the mug, she is sitting up in bed, smoking another cigarette, and just like a woman, cleaning out his wallet, which is something that he has not done since, well, since he first made it 10 years ago in a Konomawoc, in fulfillment of the requirements for the leatherworking merit badge. Julieta has pulled the stuffing out of the thing and is going through it as if it were a paperback book. Much of the stuff in there has been ruined by seawater, but she is looking, analytically, at a snapshot of glory.
"Give me that,"
he says, and snatches it from her. If she were his lover, she would try to play keep away with him. There would be silliness and, perhaps, more sex at the end of it, but she is a stranger now, and she lets him have the wallet. She watches him set down the coffee as if he's a waiter in a cafe.
"You have a girlfriend. Where? In Mexico?"
"Manila,"
Bobby Shafto says.
"If she's even still alive."
Julieta nods, completely impassive. She is neither jealous of Glory nor worried about Glory's fate at the hands of the Nips. What's happening in the Philippines can't be any worse than what she's seen in Finland. And why should she care anyway about the past romantic entanglements of her uncle Stevedore, young what's-his-name? Shafto pulls on boxers, wool pants, a shirt, and a sweater.
"I'm going into town," he says. "Tell Otto I'll be back to unload the boat."
Julieta says nothing. As a last polite gesture, Shafto stops at the door, reaches behind a stack of crates, hauls out the Suomi machine pistol, and checks it. It goes without saying that the Finns have to have their own sui generis brand of automatic weapon. Clean, loaded, ready for action, just like it was about an hour ago, the last time he checked it. He puts it back in its place, turns around, locks eyes with Julieta for a moment. Then he goes out and pulls the door shut. Behind him, he can hear her naked feet on the cold floor and the satisfying sound of the door's bolts being rammed home. He steps into a pair of tall rubber boots and then begins to trudge south along the beach. The boots are Otto's and are a couple of sizes too big for his feet. They make him feel like a little boy splashing through puddles in Wisconsin. This is what a boy of his age ought to be doing. Working, hard and honest, at a simple job. Kissing girls. Walking into town to buy some smokes and maybe have a beer. The idea of flying around on heavily armed warplanes and using modern weapon systems to kill hundreds of foreign homicidal maniacs now strikes him as dated and inappropriate. He slows down every few hundred yards to look at a steel drum or other war debris cast up by the waves, half buried in sand, stenciled cryptically in Cyrillic or Finnish or German. They remind him of the Nipponese drums on that Guadalcanal beach. "Moon lifts sea, but not the ones who sleep on the beach. Each wave a shovel." A lot of stuff gets wasted in a war, not just stuff that comes in crates and drums. It frequently happens, for example, that men are called upon to die willingly that others may live. Shafto learned on Guadalcanal that you can never tell when circumstances will make you into that guy. You can go into battle with the clearest, simplest, smartest plan ever devised, worked out by Annapolis-trained, battle-hardened Marine officers and based upon tons of intelligence. But 10 seconds after the first trigger has been pulled, shit is happening all over the place. People are running around like maniacs. The battle plan that was genius a minute ago suddenly looks as sweetly naive as the inscriptions in your high school yearbook. Guys are dying. Some of them are dying because a shell happens to fall on them, but surprisingly often, they are dying because they are ordered to. It was like that with U-691. That whole thing with the Trinidadian steamer was probably a brilliant plan. Waterhouses, he suspects, at some point. But then it all went wrong, and some Allied commander gave the order that Shafto and Root, along with the crew of U-691, were to die. He should have died on the beach on Guadalcanal, along with his buddies, and he didn't. Everything between then and U-691 was just sort of an extra bonus life. He got a chance to go home and see his family, sort of like Jesus after the resurrection. Now Bobby Shafto is dead for sure. This is why he walks so slowly down the beach and takes such a brotherly interest in these items, because Bobby Shafto is, too, a corpse washed up on the beach in Sweden. He is thinking about this when he sees the heavenly apparition. The sky here is like a freshly galvanized bucket that has been inverted over the world to block out inconvenient sunlight. If someone lights up a cigarette half a mile away, it blazes like a nova. By those standards, the heavenly apparition looks like a whole galaxy falling out of orbit to graze the surface of the world. You could almost mistake it for an airplane, except that it does not make that requisite, chesty, droning thrum. This thing emits a screaming whine and a long trail of fire. Besides, it goes too fast for an airplane. It comes streaking in from the Gulf of Bothnia and crosses the shoreline a couple of miles north of Otto's cabin, gradually losing altitude and slowing down. But as it slows down, the flames burgeon and claw their way forward up the thing's black body, which resembles the crumpled, curling wick at the root of a candle flame. It disappears behind trees. Around here, everything disappears behind trees sooner or later. A ball of fire erupts from those trees, and Bobby Shafto says,
1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, 1006, 1007,
and then stops, hearing the explosion. Then he turns around and walks into Norsbrook, going faster now. Lavender Rose. Randy wants to go down and look at the U-boat in person. Doug says evenly that Randy is welcome to do so, but he needs to draw up a valid dive plan first, and reminds him that the depth of the wreck is 154 meters. Randy nods as if he had, of course, expected to draw up a dive plan. He wants everything to be like driving cars, where you just hop in and go. He knows a couple of guys who fly airplanes, and he can still remember how he felt when he learned that you can't just get in a plane, even a small one, and take off. You have to have a flight plan, and it takes a whole briefcase full of books and tables and specialized calculators and access to weather forecasts above and beyond the normal consumer-grade weather forecasts to come up with even a bad, wrong flight plan that will surely kill you. Once Randy has gotten used to this idea, he grudgingly admitted it made sense. Now Doug Shafto's telling him he needs a plan just to strap some tanks on his back and swim 154 meters, straight down, admittedly, and back. So Randy yanks a couple of diving books off the bungeed shelves of Glory 4 and tries to come up with even a vague idea of what Doug's talking about. Randy has never gone scuba diving in his life, but he's seen them doing it on Jacques Cousteau, and it seems straightforward enough. The first three books he consults contain more than enough detail to perfectly reproduce the crestfallenness that Randy experienced when he learned about flight plans. Before he'd opened the books, Randy had gotten out his mechanical pencil and his graph paper in preparation for making marks on the page. Half an hour later, he's still trying to get a handle on the contents of the tables, and he hasn't made any marks at all. He notes that the depths in these tables only go down as far as 130, and at that level, they only talk in terms of staying down there 5 or 10 minutes. And yet he knows that Amy and the Shafto's colorful and ever-enlarging cast of polyethnic scuba divers are spending much longer at this depth, and are in fact beginning to come up to the surface with artifacts from the wreck. There is, for example, an aluminum briefcase wherein Doug hopes to find clues as to who was on this U-boat and why it was on the wrong side of the planet. Randy begins to fear that the entire wreck is going to be stripped bare before he even makes any marks on his piece of graph paper. The divers show up, one or two each day, on speedboats or outrigger canoes from Palawan. Blonde surf boys, taciturn galoots, cigarette-smoking Frenchmen, Nintendo-playing Asians, beer-can-crumpling ex-Navy guys, blue-collar hillbillies. They all have diving plans. Why doesn't Randy have a diving plan? He starts sketching one out, based on the depth of 130, which seems reasonably close to 154. After working on it for about an hour, long enough to imagine all sorts of specious details, he happens to notice that the table he's been using is in feet, not meters. which means that all of these divers have been going down to a depth that is way more than 3 times as deep as the maximum that is even talked about on these tables. Randy closes up all of the books and looks at them peevishly for a while. They are all nice new books with color photographs on the covers. He picked them off the shelf because, getting introspective here, he is a computer guy, and in the computer world, any book printed more than 2 months ago is a campy nostalgia item. Investigating a little more, he finds that all 3 of these shiny new books have been personally autographed by the authors, with long personal inscriptions. 2 addressed to Doug, and 1 to Amy. The 1 to Amy has obviously been written by a man who is desperately in love with her. Reading it is like moisturizing with Tabasco. He concludes that these are all consumer-grade diving books written for rum-drenched tourists, and furthermore that the publishers probably had teams of lawyers go over them 1 word at a time to make sure there would not be liability trouble. That the contents of these books, therefore, probably represent about 1% of everything that the authors actually know about diving, but that the lawyers have made sure that the authors don't even mention that. Okay, so divers have mastered a large body of occult knowledge. That explains their general resemblance to hackers, albeit physically fit hackers. Doug Shafto is not going down to the wreck himself. As a matter of fact, he looked surprised, bordering on contemptuous, when Randy asked him whether he would go down. Instead, he's going over the stuff that is brought up from the wreck by the younger divers. They began by doing a photographic survey using digital cameras, and Doug's been printing out blow-ups of the inside of the U-boat on his laser printer and pasting them up around the walls of his personal wardroom on Glory 4. Randy does a sorting procedure on the diving books now. He ignores anything that has color photographs, or that appears to have been published within the last 20 years, or that has any quotes on the back cover containing the words stunning, superb, user-friendly, or, worst of all, easy to understand. He looks for old, thick books with worn-out bindings and block-lettered titles like Dive Manual. Anything with angry marginal notes written by Doug Shafto gets extra points. 2. Randy@epiphyte.com. From: root@aruditorum.org. Subject: Pontifex. Randy. For now, let's use Pontifex as the working title of this crypto system. It is a post-war system. What I mean by that is that after seeing what Turing and company did to Enigma, I came to the now obvious conclusion that any modern system had better be resistant to machine cryptanalysis. Pontifex uses a 54-element permutation as its key, 1 key per message, mind you, and it uses that permutation, which we will denote as T, to generate a key stream which is added, modulo 26, to the plaintext, P, as in a one-time pad. The process of generating each character in the key stream alters T in a reversible but more or less random fashion. At this point, a diver comes up with a piece of actual gold, but it's not a bar. It's a sheet of hammered gold, maybe 8 inches on a side and about 0.25 millimeter thick, with a pattern of tiny, neat holes punched through it, like a computer card. Randy spends a couple of days obsessing over this artifact. He learns that it came out of a crate stored in the hold of the U-boat, and that there are thousands more of them. Now, all of a sudden, he's reading stuff by guys whose names are preceded by naval ranks and succeeded by MDs and PhDs, and they are going on for dozens of pages about the physics of nitrogen bubble formation in the knee, for example. There are photographs of cats strapped down in benchtop pressure chambers. Randy learns that the reason Doug Shafto doesn't dive to 154 meters is that certain age-related changes in the joints tend to increase the likelihood of bubble formation during the decompression process. He comes to terms with the fact that the pressure at the depth of the wreck is going to be 15 or 16 atmospheres, meaning that as he ascends to the surface, any nitrogen bubbles that happen to be rattling around in his body are going to get 15 or 16 times as large as they were to begin with, and that this is true whether those bubbles happen to be in his brain, his knee, the little blood vessels of the eyeball, or trapped underneath his fillings. He develops a sophisticated layman's understanding of dive medicine, which amounts to little because everyone's body is different. Hence the need for each diver to have a completely different dive plan. Randy will need to figure out his body fat percentage before he can even begin marking up his sheet of graph paper. It is also path-dependent. These divers' bodies get partly saturated with nitrogen every time they go down, and not all of it goes out of their bodies when they come back up. All of them, sitting around Glory 4, playing cards, drinking beer, talking to their girlfriends on their GSM phones, are all outgassing all the time. Nitrogen is seeping out of their bodies into the atmosphere, and each one of them knows more or less how much nitrogen stuffed into his body at any given moment and understands in a deep and nearly intuitive way just exactly how that information propagates through any dive plan that he might be cooking up inside the powerful dive planning supercomputer that each of these guys apparently carries around in his nitrogen-saturated brain. One of the divers comes up with a plank from the crates that contain the stacks of gold sheets. It is in very bad shape, and it's still fizzing as gas comes out of it. Fizzing in a way that Randy has no trouble imagining his bones would do if he made any errors in working out his dive plan. There is some stenciled lettering just barely visible on the wood. NIS-ARCH. Glory 4 has compressors for pumping air up to insanely high pressures to fill the scuba tanks. Randy develops an awareness that the pressure has to be insanely high, or it won't even emerge from the tanks while these guys are down at depth. The divers are all being suffused with this pressurized gas. He half expects that one of these divers is going to bump into something and explode into a pink mushroom cloud. 2. Randy at epiphyte.com. From Cantrell at epiphyte.com. Subject, Pontifex. R. You forwarded me a message about a cryptosystem called Pontifex. Was this invented by a friend of yours? In its general outlines, namely, an element permutation that is used to generate a keystream and that slowly evolves, it is similar to a commercial system called RC4, which enjoys a complicated reputation among secret admirers. It seems secure and has not been broken, but it makes us nervous because it is basically a single-rotor system, albeit a rotor that evolves. Pontifex evolves in a much more complicated and asymmetrical way than RC4, and so might be more secure. Some things about Pontifex are slightly peculiar. 1. He talks about generating characters in the keystream and then adding them, modulo 26, to the plaintext. This is how people talked 50 years ago when ciphers were worked out using pencil and paper. Today we talk in terms of generating bytes and adding them modulo 256. Is your friend pretty old? 2. He speaks of T as a 54-element permutation. There is nothing wrong with that, but Pontifex would work just as well with 64 or 73 or 699 elements, so it makes more sense to describe it as an N-element permutation where N could be 54 or any other integer. I can't figure out why he settled on 54. Possibly because it is twice the number of letters in the alphabet, but this makes no particular sense. Conclusion. The author of Pontifex is cryptologically sophisticated but shows possible signs of being an elderly crank. I need more details in order to deliver a verdict. Cantrell.
Randy,
says Doug Shafto, and beckons him into his wardroom. The inside of the wardroom door is decorated with a big color photograph of a massive stone staircase in a dusty church. They stand in front of it.
Are there a lot of water houses?
Doug asks.
Is it a common name?
Well,
it's not a rare name. Is there anything you'd like to share with me about your family history?
Randy knows that as a possible suitor to Amy, he will be undergoing thorough scrutiny at all times. The Shaftos are doing due diligence on him.
What kind of things are you looking for? Something terrible? I don't think there's anything worth hiding from you.
Doug stares at him distractedly for a while, then turns to face the now open aluminum briefcase from the U-boat. Randy supposes that merely opening it required coming up with a detailed plan. Doug has spread out miscellaneous contents on a tabletop to be photographed and cataloged. Ex-Navy SEAL Douglas MacArthur Shafto has, at the peak of his career, become a sort of librarian. Randy sees a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles, a fountain pen, a few rusty paper clips. But it looks as though a lot of sodden paper was taken out of that briefcase, too, and Doug Shafto has been carefully drying it out and trying to read it.
Most wartime paper was crap,
he says.
It probably dissolved into mush within days of the sinking. The paper in this briefcase was at least protected from marine critters, but most of it's gone. However, the owner of this briefcase was apparently some sort of aristocrat. Check out the glasses, the pen.
Randy checks them out. The divers have found teeth and fillings in the wreck, but nothing that qualifies as a body. The places where people died are marked by these trails of hard, inert remains, such as eyeglasses, like the debris footprint of an exploded airliner.
So what I'm getting at is that he had a few scraps of good paper in his briefcase,
Doug continues.
Personal stationery. So we suspect his name was Rudolf von Heckelhaber. Does that name ring any bells with you?
No, but I could do a web search.
I tried that,
Doug says.
Turned up just a few hits. There was a man by that name who wrote a couple of mathematics papers back in the 30s. And there are some organizations in and around Leipzig, Germany that used the name. A hotel, a theater, a defunct reinsurance company. That's about it.
Well, if he was a mathematician, he might have had some connection with my grandfather.
Is that why you were asking about my family?
Check this out,
Doug says, and pings one fingernail against a glass tray full of a transparent liquid. An envelope, unglued and spread-eagled, is floating in it. Randy bends over and peers at it. Something has been written on the back in pencil, but it's impossible to read because the flaps of the envelope have been spread apart.
May I?
He asks. Doug nods and hands him a couple of latex surgical gloves.
I don't have to file a diving plan for this, do I?
Randy asks, wiggling his fingers into the gloves. Doug is not amused.
It is deeper than it looks,
he says. Randy flips the envelope over, then folds the flaps back together, reassembling the inscription. It says, Waterhouse, Lavender Rose. Brisbane. Through a small, dusty window etched with masking tape, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse gazes out at downtown Brisbane. Bustling, it ain't. A taxi limps down the street and pulls into the drive of the nearby Canberra Hotel, which is home to many mid-ranking officers. The taxi smokes and reeks. It is powered by a charcoal burner in the trunk. Marching feet can be heard through the window. It's not the tromp-tromp of combat boots, but the whack-whack of sensible shoes worn by sensible women. Local volunteers. Waterhouse instinctively leans closer to the window to get a look at them. But he's wasting his time. Dressed in those uniforms, you could march a regiment of pin-up girls through all the cabins and gangways of an active battleship and not draw a single wolf whistle, lewd suggestion, or butt grab. A delivery truck creeps out of a side street and backfires alarmingly as it tries to accelerate onto the main drag. Brisbane is still worried about attack from the air, and no one likes sudden loud noises. The truck looks like it is being attacked by an amoeba. On its back is a billowing rubberized canvas balloon full of natural gas. He's on the third floor of a commercial building so nondescript that the most interesting observation one can make about it is that it has four stories. There is a tobacconist on the ground floor. The rest of the place must have been empty until the general, beaten like a red-headed stepchild by those nips, came to Brisbane from Corregidor and made this city into the capital of the Southwest Pacific Theater. There must have been an incredible amount of surplus office space around here before the general showed up, because a lot of Brisbaneers had fled south, expecting an invasion. Waterhouse has had plenty of time to familiarize himself with Brisbane and its environs. He's been here for 4 weeks, and he's been given nothing to do. When he was in Britain, they couldn't shuffle him around fast enough. Whatever his job was at the moment, he did it feverishly, until he received top-secret highest-priority orders to rush by any available means of transportation to his next assignment. Then they brought him here. The Navy flew him across the Pacific, hopping from one island base to the next in an assortment of flying boats and transports. He crossed the equator and the international dateline on the same day. But when he reached the boundary between Nimitz's Pacific Theater and the General's Southwest Pacific Theater, it was like he had glided into a stone wall. It was all he could do to talk himself on board a troop transport to New Zealand, and then to Fremantle. The transports were almost unbelievably hellish. Steel ovens packed with men, baked by the sun, no one allowed to go above decks for fear they'd be sighted and marked for slaughter by a Nip submarine. Even at night, they couldn't get a breeze through there, because all openings had to be covered with blackout curtains. Waterhouse couldn't really complain. Some of the men had traveled this way all the way from the east coast of the United States. The important thing was that he made it to Brisbane, as per his orders, and reported to the right officer, who told him to await further orders. Which he's been doing until this morning, when he was told to show up at this office upstairs of the tobacconist. It is a room full of enlisted men typing up forms, trundling them around in wire baskets, and filing them. In Waterhouse's experience with the military, he has found that it's not a good sign when one is ordered to report to a place like this. Finally, he is allowed into the presence of an army major who has several other conversations and various pieces of important paperwork going on at the same time. That is okay. Waterhouse doesn't need to be a cryptanalyst to get the message loud and clear, which is that he is not wanted here.
"Marshall sent you here because he thinks that the general is sloppy with Ultra," the major says.
Waterhouse flinches to hear this word spoken aloud in an office where enlisted men and women volunteers are coming and going. It's almost as if the major wishes to make it clear that the general is, in fact, quite sloppy with Ultra, and rather likes it that way, thank you very much.
"Marshall's afraid that the Nips will get wise to us and change their code. That's all because of Churchill."
The major refers to General George C. Marshall and Sir Winston Churchill as if they were bullpen staff for a farm league baseball team. He pauses to light a cigarette.
"Ultra is Churchill's baby. Oh, yeah, Winnie just loves his Ultra. He thinks we're gonna blow his secret and ruin it for him because he thinks we're idiots."
The major takes a very deep lungful of smoke, sits back in his chair, and carefully puffs out a couple of smoke rings. It is a convincing display of insouciance.
"So he's always nagging Marshall to tighten up security, and Marshall throws him a bone every so often just to keep the alliance on an even keel."
For the first time, the major looks Waterhouse in the eye.
"You happen to be the latest bone, that's all."
There is a long silence, as if Waterhouse is expected to say something. He clears his throat. No one ever got court-martialed for following his orders.
"My orders state that..." "Fuck your orders, Captain Waterhouse,"
the major says. There is a long silence. The major tends to one or two other distracting duties. Then he stares out the window for a few moments, trying to compose his thoughts. Finally, he says,
"Get this through your head. We are not idiots. The general is not an idiot. The general appreciates Ultra as much as Sir Winston Churchill. The general uses Ultra as well as any commander in this war."
"Ultra's no good if the Japanese learn about it."
"As you can appreciate, the general does not have time to meet with you personally. Neither does his staff. So you will not have an opportunity to instruct him on how to keep Ultra a secret,"
says the major. He glances down a couple of times at a sheet of paper on his blotter, and indeed he is now speaking like a man who is reading a prepared statement.
"From time to time, since we learned that you are being sent to us, your existence has been brought to the general's attention. During the brief periods of time when he is not occupied with more pressing matters, he has occasionally voiced some pithy thoughts about you, your mission, and the masterminds who sent you here."
"No doubt," Waterhouse says.
"The general is of the opinion that persons not familiar with the unique features of the Southwest Pacific Theater may not be entirely competent to judge his strategy,"
says the major.
"The general feels that the Nips will never learn about Ultra. Never. Why? Because they are incapable of comprehending what has happened to them. The general has speculated that he could go down to the radio station tomorrow and broadcast a speech announcing that we had broken all of the NIP codes and were reading all of their messages and nothing would happen. The general's words were something to the effect that the NIPs will never believe how totally we have fucked them, because when you get fucked that badly, it's your own goddamn fucking fault and it makes you look like a fucking shithead.
I see, Waterhouse says.
But the general said all of that at much greater length and without using a single word of profanity, because that is how the general expresses himself.
Thank you for boiling it down, Waterhouse says.
You know those white headbands that the NIPs tie around their foreheads, with a meatball and the NIP characters printed on them?
I've seen pictures of them.
I've seen them for real, tied around the heads of pilots of NIP fighter planes that were about 50 feet away firing machine guns at me and my men, says the major.
Oh, yeah, me too, at Pearl Harbor, Waterhouse says. I forgot. This happens to be the most irritating thing that Waterhouse has said all day. The major has to spend a moment composing himself.
That headband is called a hachimaki.
Oh.
Imagine this, Waterhouse. The emperor is meeting with his general staff. All of the top generals and admirals in Nippon parade into the room in full dress uniforms and bow down solemnly before the emperor. They have come to report on the progress of the war. Each of these generals and admirals is wearing a brand new hachimaki around his forehead. These hachimakis are printed with phrases saying things like, I am a dipshit, and through my personal incompetence, I killed 200,000 of my own men, and I handed our Midway plans over to Nimitz on a silver platter.
The major now pauses and takes a phone call so that Waterhouse can savor this image for a while. Then he hangs up, lights another cigarette, and continues.
That's what it would look like for the NIPs to admit at this point in the war that we have Ultra.
More smoke rings. Waterhouse has nothing to say. So the major continues.
See, we've gone over the watershed line of this war. We won Midway. We won North Africa, Stalingrad, the Battle of the Atlantic. Everything changes when you go over the watershed line. The rivers all flow a different direction. It's as if the force of gravity itself has changed and is now working in our favor. We've adjusted to that. Marshall and Churchill and all the others are still stuck in an obsolete mentality. They are defenders. But the general is not a defender. As a matter of fact, just between you and me, the general is lousy on defense, as he demonstrated in the Philippines. The general is a conqueror.
Well, Waterhouse finally says, what do you suggest I do with myself, seeing as how I'm here in Brisbane?
I'm tempted to say you should connect up with all the other ultra-security experts Marshall sent out before you and get a bridge group together,
the major says. I don't care for bridge, Waterhouse says politely.
You're supposed to be some expert codebreaker, right?
Right.
Why don't you go to Central Bureau? The NIPs have a zillion different codes and we haven't broken all of them yet.
That's not my mission.
You don't worry about your fucking mission, the major says. I'll make sure that Marshall thinks you're doing your mission, because if Marshall doesn't think that, he'll give us no end of hassles. So you're clean with the higher-ups.
Thank you.
You can consider your mission accomplished, the major says. Congratulations.
Thank you.
My mission is to beat the stuffing out of the fucking NIPs, and that mission is not accomplished just yet, and so I have other matters to attend to,
the major says significantly. Shall I just see myself out, then? Waterhouse asks. Durnitz. Once, when Bobby Shafto was 8 years old, he went to Tennessee to visit Grandma and Grandpa. One boring afternoon, he began skimming a letter that the old lady had left lying on an end table. Grandma gave him a stern talking to and then recounted the incident to Grandpa, who recognized his cue and gave him 40 whacks. That, and a whole series of roughly parallel childhood experiences, plus several years in the Marine Corps, have made him into one polite fellow. So he doesn't read others' mail. It be against the rules. But here he is. The setting, a plank-paneled room above a pub in Norsbrook, Sweden. The pub is a sailorly kind of place, catering to fishermen, which makes it congenial for Shafto's friend and drinking buddy, Kapitan Leutnant Gunter Bischoff, Kriegsmarine of the Third Reich, retired.
Bischoff gets a lot of interesting mail and leaves it strewn all over the room. Some of the mail is from his family in Germany, and contains money. Consequently, Bischoff, unlike Shafto, will not have to work even if this war continues, and he remains in Sweden, cooling his boilers for another 10 years. Some of the mail is from the crew of U-691, according to Bischoff. After Bischoff got them all here to Norsbrook in one piece, his second-in-command, Oberleutnant José Karl Beck, cut a deal with the Kriegsmarine in which the crew were allowed to return to Germany. No hard feelings, no repercussions. All of them, except for Bischoff, climbed on board what was left of U-691 and steamed off in the direction of Kiel. Only days later, the mail began to pour in. Every member of the crew, to a man, sent Bischoff a letter describing the hero's welcome they had received. Dönitz himself met them at the pier and handed out hugs and kisses and medals and other tokens in embarrassing profusion. They can't stop talking about how much they want dear Gunther to come back home. Dear Gunther isn't budging. He's been sitting in his little room for a couple of months now. His world consists of pen, ink, paper, candles, cups of coffee, bottles of aquavit, the soothing beat of the surf. Every crash of wave on shore, he says, reminds him that he is above sea level now, where men were meant to live. His mind is always back there, 100 feet below the surface of the gelid Atlantic, trapped like a rat in a sewer pipe, cringing from the explosions of the depth charges. He lived 100 years that way and spent every moment of those 100 years dreaming of the surface. He vowed 10,000 times that if he ever made it back up to the world of air and light, he would enjoy every breath, revel in every moment. That's pretty much what he's been doing here in Norsbrook. He has his personal journal, and he's been going through it, page by page, filling in all of the details that he didn't have time to jot down before he forgets them. Someday, after the war, it'll make a book. One of a million war memoirs that will clog libraries from Novosibirsk to Gander to Squim to Batavia. The pace of incoming mail dropped dramatically after the first weeks. Several of his men still write to him faithfully. Shafto is used to seeing their letters scattered around the place when he comes to visit. Most of them are written on scraps of cheap grayish paper. Directionless silver light infiltrates the room through Bischoff's window, illuminating what looks like a rectangular pool of heavy cream on his tabletop. It is some kind of official Hun stationery, surmounted by a raptor clenching a swastika. The letter is handwritten, not typed. When Bischoff sets his wet glass down on it, the ink dissolves. And when Bischoff goes to empty his bladder, Shafto can't keep his eyes away from it. He knows that this is bad manners, but the Second World War has led him into all sorts of uncouth behavior, and there don't seem to be any angry grandpas lurking in the trenches with doubled belts. No consequences at all for the wicked, in fact. Maybe that will change in a couple of years if the Germans and the Nips lose the war. But that reckoning will be so great and terrible that Shafto's glance at Bischoff's letter will probably go unnoticed. It came in an envelope. The first line of the address is very long and consists of Gunther Bischoff, preceded by a string of ranks and titles, and followed by a series of letters. The return address has been savaged by Bischoff's letter opener, but it's somewhere in Berlin. The letter itself is an impossible snarl of Germanic cursive. It is signed hugely with a single word. Shafto spends some time trying to make out that word. He who's John Huncock, this is, must have an ego that ranks right up there with the generals. When Shafto figures out the signature belongs to Dönitz, he gets all tingly. That Dönitz is an important guy. Shafto's even seen him on a newsreel congratulating a grimy U-boat crew fresh from a salty spree. Why is he writing love notes to Bischoff? Shafto can't read this stuff any better than he could Nipponese, but he can see a few figures. Dönitz is talking numbers. Perhaps tons of shipping sunk or casualties on the Eastern Front. Perhaps money.
Oh, yes, Bischoff says, having somehow reappeared in the room without making any noise.
When you're down in a U-boat, running silent, you learn how to walk quietly.
I have come up with a hypothesis on the gold.
What gold?
Shafto says. He knows, of course, but having been caught in an act of flagrant naughtiness, his instinct is to play innocent.
Such you saw down in the batteries of U-553, Bischoff says. You see, my friend, anyone else would say that you are simply a crazy jughead.
The correct term is jarhead.
They would say, first of all, that U-553 sank many months before you claimed to have seen it. Secondly, they would say that such a boat could not have been loaded with gold. But I believe that you saw it.
So?
Bischoff glances at the letter from Durnitz, looking mildly seasick.
I must tell you something about the Wehrmacht of which I am ashamed first.
What? That they invaded Poland and France? No. That they invaded Russia and Norway?
No, not that.
That they bombed England?
No, no, no,
Bischoff says, the very model of forbearance.
Something you did not know about.
What?
It seems that while I have been sneaking around the Atlantic doing my duty, the Fuhrer has come up with a little incentive program.
What do you mean?
It seems that duty and loyalty are not enough for certain high-ranking officers, so they will not carry out their orders to the fullest unless they receive special awards.
Well, you mean like medals?
Bischoff is smiling nervously.
Some generals on the Eastern Front have been given estates in Russia. Very, very large estates.
Oh.
But not everyone can be bribed with land. Some people require a more liquid form of compensation.
Booze?
No, I mean liquid in the financial sense. Something you can carry with you and that is accepted in any whorehouse on the planet.
Gold,
says Shafto quietly.
Gold would suffice, Bischoff says.
It has been a long time since he looked Shafto in the eye. He's staring out the window instead. His green eyes might be a little moist. He takes a deep breath, blinks, and gets the bitter irony under control before continuing.
Since Stalingrad, it has not gone well on the Eastern Front. Let us say that Ukrainian real estate is no longer worth what it used to be if the deed to the land happens to be written in German and issued in Berlin.
It's getting harder to bribe a general by promising him a chunk of Russian land,
Shafto translates.
So Hitler needs lots of gold.
Yes. Now, the Japanese have lots of gold. Consider that they sacked China, as well as many other places. But they are lacking in certain things. They need wolframite, mercury, uranium.
What's uranium?
Who the hell knows? The Japanese want it, we provide it. We provide them technology, too. Blueprints for new turbines. Enigma machines.
At this point, Bischoff breaks off and laughs, painfully and darkly, for a long time. When he gets it under control, he continues,
So, we have been shipping them these things in U-boats.
And the Nips pay you in gold.
Yes. It is a dark economy, hidden beneath the ocean, trading small but valuable items over vast distances. You got a glimpse of it.
Well, you knew this was going on, but you didn't know about U-553,
Shafto points out.
Bobby, there are many, many things going on in the Third Reich that a mere U-boat captain does not know about. You are a soldier. You know this is true.
Yes,
Shafto says, recalling the peculiarities of Detachment 2702. He looks down at the letter.
Why is Durnitz telling you all of this now?
He is not telling me anything,
Bischoff says reprovingly.
I have figured this out myself.
He gnaws on a lip for a while.
Durnitz is making me a proposition.
I thought you'd retired.
Bischoff considers it.
I have retired from killing people. But the other day I sailed a little sloop around the inlet.
So?
So it seems that I have not retired from going down to the sea in ships.
Bischoff heaves a sigh.
Unfortunately, all of the really interesting ships are owned by major governments.
Bischoff is getting a little spooky, so Shafto opts for a little change in the subject.
Hey, speaking of really interesting things...
And he tells the story of the heavenly apparition that he saw while he was walking down here. Bischoff is delighted by the story, which revives the hunger for excitement that he has kept pickled in salt and alcohol ever since reaching Norsbrook.
You're sure it was man-made?
He asks.
It whined. Chunks of shit were falling out of it, but I've never seen a meteor, so I don't know.
How far away?
It crashed 7 kilometers from where I was standing, so 10 clicks from here.
But 10 kilometers is nothing for an Eagle Scout and a Hitler Youth.
You weren't a Hitler Youth.
Bischoff broods over this for a moment.
Hitler, so embarrassing. I hoped that if I ignored him, he would go away. Perhaps if I had joined the Hitler Youth, they would have given me a surface ship.
Then you'd be dead.
Right.
Bischoff's mood brightens considerably.
10 kilometers is still nothing. Let's go.
It's already dark.
We will follow the flames.
They will have gone out.
We will follow the trail of debris, like Hansel and Gretel.
It didn't work for Hansel and Gretel. Didn't you even read the fucking story?
Don't be such a defeatist, Bobby,
says Bischoff, diving into a hearty fisherman's sweater.
Normally, you are not like this. What is troubling you?
Glory.
It is October, and the days are growing short. Shafto and Bischoff, both mired in the yet-to-be-discovered emotional dumps of seasonal affective disorder, are like two brothers trapped in the same pit of quicksand, each keeping a sharp eye on the other.
Eh? Was ist los, buddy?
I guess I'm just feeling at loose ends.
You need an adventure. Let's go.
I need an adventure like Hitler needs an ugly little toothbrush mustache,
says Bobby Shafto. But he drags himself up out of his chair and follows Bischoff out the door. Shafto and Bischoff are trudging through the dark Swedish woods like a pair of lost souls trying to find the side entrance to Limbo. They take turns carrying the kerosene lantern, which has an effective range about as long as a grown man's arm. Sometimes they go for a whole hour without talking, each man alone with his own struggle against suicidal depression. Then one of them, usually Bischoff, will perk up and say something like,
"Haven't seen Enoch Root recently. What has he been up to since he finished curing you of your morphine addiction?"
Bischoff asks.
"Don't know. He was such a fucking pain in the ass during that project that I never wanted to see him again. But I think he got a Russian radio transmitter from Otto and took it into that church basement where he lives. He's been messing around with it ever since."
"Yes, I remember. It was changing the frequencies. Did he ever get it to work?"
"Beats me,"
Shafto says.
"But when big pieces of burned shit start falling out of the sky in my neighborhood, makes me wonder."
"Yes. Also, he goes to the post office quite frequently," Bischoff says. "I chatted with him there once. He is carrying on a heavy correspondence with others around the world."
"Other what?"
"That is my question, too."
Eventually, they find the wreck only by following the sound of a hacksaw, which reverberates through the pines like the shriek of some extraordinarily stupid and horny bird. This enables them to home in on it in a general way. Final coordinates are provided by a sudden strobe-like flashing light, devastating noise, and a sap-scented rain of amputated foliage. Shafto and Bischoff both hit the dirt and lie there listening to fat pistol slugs ricocheting from tree trunk to tree trunk. The hacksawing noise continues with no break in rhythm. Bischoff starts talking Swedish, but Shafto shushes him.
"That was a Suomi,"
he says.
"Hey, Julietta, knock it off! It's just me and Gunter."
There is no answer. Then, Shafto remembers that he has recently fucked Julietta, and therefore needs to remember his manners.
"Excuse me, ma'am,"
he says,
"but I gather from the sound of your weapon that you are of the Finnish nation, for which I have unbounded admiration, and I wanted to let you know that I, former Sergeant Robert Shafto, and my friend, former Kapitan Leutnant Gunter Bischoff, mean you no harm."
Julietta, homing in on the sound of his voice in the darkness, responds with a controlled burst of fire that passes over a foot over Bobby Shafto's head.
"Don't you belong in Manila?"
she asks. Shafto groans and rolls over on his back as if he has been shot in the gut. "What does she mean by this?" asks the bewildered Gunter Bischoff. Seeing that his friend has been emotionally incapacitated, he tries.
"This is Sweden, a peaceful and neutral country. Why are you trying to machine gun us?"
"Go away!"
Julieta must be with Otto, because they hear her talk to him before saying,
"We do not want representatives of the American Marines and the Wehrmacht here. You are not welcome."
"Sounds like you're sawing away on something that is pretty damn heavy,"
Shafto finally retorts.
"How are you going to haul it out of these woods?"
This leads to an animated conversation between Julieta and Otto.
"You may approach,"
Julieta finally says. They find the Cavistics, Julieta and Otto, standing in a pool of lantern light around the severed, charred wing of an airplane. Most Finns are hard to tell apart from Swedes, but Otto and Julieta both have black hair and black eyes and could pass for Turks. The tip of the airplane wing is painted with the black and white cross of the Luftwaffe. An engine is mounted to that wing. If Otto's hacksaw has its way, it won't be for much longer. The engine has recently been set on fire and then used to knock down a large number of pine trees. But even so, Shafto can see it's like no engine he has ever seen before. There is no propeller, but there are a lot of little fan blades.
"It looks like a turbine," says Bischoff, "but for air rather than water."
Otto straightens up, squeezes his lower back theatrically, and hands Shafto the hacksaw. Then he hands him a bottle of Benzedrine tablets for good measure. Shafto eats a few tablets, strips off his shirt to reveal splendid musculature, does a couple of USMC-approved stretching exercises, grabs the hacksaw, and sets to work. After a couple of minutes, he looks up nonchalantly at Julieta, who is standing there holding the machine pistol and watching him with a look that is simultaneously frosty and smoldering, like baked Alaska. Bischoff stands off to the side, reveling in this. Dawn is slapping her chapped and reddened fingers against a frost-bitten sky, attempting to restore some circulation, when the remains of the turbine finally fall away from the wing. Pumped on Benzedrine, Shafto has been operating the hacksaw for 6 hours. Otto has stepped in to change blades several times, a major capital investment on his part. Next, they devote half of the morning to dragging the engine through the woods and down a creek bed to the sea, where Otto's boat is waiting, and Otto and Julieta take their prize away. Bobby Shafto and Gunter Bischoff trudge back up to the site of the wreck. They have not discussed this openly yet. It would be unnecessary, but they intend to find the part of the airplane that contains the body of the pilot, and see to it that he gets a proper burial.
"What is in Manila, Bobby?" Bischoff asks.
"Something that morphine made me forget," Shafto answers. "And that Enoch Root, that fucking bastard, made me remember."
Not 15 minutes later, they come to the gash in the woods that was carved by the plunging airplane, and hear a man's voice wailing and sobbing, completely out of his mind with grief.
"Angelo! Angelo! Angelo! My Liebchen!"
They cannot see the man who is crying out in this way, but they do see Enoch Root, standing there and brooding. He looks up alertly as they approach and produces a semi-automatic from his leather jacket. Then he recognizes them and relaxes.
"What the fuck is going on here?"
Shafto says. Never one to beat around in the bush.
"Is that a fucking German you're with?"
"Yes, I am with a German," Root says. "As are you."
"Well, why is your German making such a fucking spectacle of himself?"
"Rudy is crying over the body of his lover," Root says, "who died in an attempt to reunite with him."
"A woman was flying that plane?"
says the flabbergasted Shafto. Root rolls his eyes and heaves a sigh.
"You have forgotten to allow for the possibility that Rudy might be a homosexual."
It takes Shafto a long time to stretch his mind around this large, inconveniently shaped concept. Bischoff, in typical European fashion, seems completely unruffled. But he still has questions to ask.
Enoch, why are you here?
Why has my spirit been incarnated into a physical body in this world generally, or specifically, why am I here in a Swedish forest, standing on the wreck of a mysterious German rocket plane while a homosexual German sobs over the cremated remains of his Italian lover? Last rites, Root answers his own question. Angelo was Catholic. Then, after a while, he notices that Bischoff is staring at him, looking completely unsatisfied. Oh, I am here in a larger sense because Mrs. Tenney, the vicar's wife, has become sloppy and forgotten to close her eyes when she takes the balls out of the bingo machine.
Crunch. The condemned man showers, shaves, puts on most of a suit, and realizes that he is ahead of schedule. He turns on the television, gets a San Miguel out of the fridge to steady his nerves, and then goes to the closet to get the stuff of his last meal. The apartment only has one closet, and when its door is open, it appears to have been bricked shut, cask of Amontillado style, with very large flat red oblongs, each imprinted with the image of a venerable and yet oddly cheerful and yet somehow kind of hauntingly sad naval officer. The whole pallet load was shipped here several weeks ago by Avi in an attempt to lift Randy's spirits. For all Randy knows, more are still sitting on a Manila dockside ringed with armed guards and dictionary-sized rat traps, straining against their triggers, each baited with a single golden nugget. Randy selects one of the bricks from this wall, creating a gap in the formation, but there is another identical one right behind it, another picture of that same naval officer. They seem to be marching from his closet in a peppy phalanx.
Part of this complete balanced breakfast, Randy says.
Then he slams the door on them and walks with a measured, forcibly calm step to the living room where he does most of his dining, usually while facing his 36-inch television. He sets up his San Miguel, an empty bowl, an exceptionally large soup spoon, so large that most European cultures would identify it as a serving spoon and most Asian ones as a horticultural implement. He obtains a stack of paper napkins, not the brown, recycled ones that can't be moistened even by immersion in water, but the flagrantly environmentally unsound type, brilliant white and cotton fluffy and desperately hygroscopic. He goes to the kitchen, opens the fridge, reaches deep into the back, and finds an unopened box-bag pod unit of UHT milk. UHT milk need not technically be refrigerated, but it is pivotal in what is to follow, that the milk be only a few microdegrees above the point of freezing. The fridge in Randy's apartment has louvers in the back where the cold air is blown in, straight from the Freon coils. Randy always stores his milk pods directly in front of those louvers. Not too close, or else the pods will block the flow of air, and not too far away, either. The cold air becomes visible as it rushes in and condenses moisture, so it is a simple matter to sit there with the fridge door open and observe its flow characteristics, like an engineer testing an experimental minivan in a River Rouge wind tunnel. What Randy would like to see, ideally, is the whole milk pod enveloped in an even, jacket-like flow to produce better heat exchange. He would like the milk to be so cold that when he reaches in and grabs it, he feels the flexible, squishy pod stiffen between his fingers as ice crystals spring into existence, summoned out of nowhere simply by the disturbance of being squished. Today the milk is almost, but not quite, that cold. Randy goes into his living room with it. He has to wrap it in a towel because it is so cold it hurts his fingers. He launches a videotape and then sits down. All is in readiness. This is one of a series of videotapes that are shot in an empty basketball gym with a polished maple floor and a howling, remorseless ventilation system. They depict a young man and a young woman, both attractive, svelte, and dressed something like marquee players in the Ice Capades, performing simple ballroom dance steps to the accompaniment of strangled music from a ghetto blaster set up on the free throw line. it is miserably clear that the video has been shot by a third conspirator who is burdened with a consumer-grade camcorder and reeling from some kind of inner ear disease that he or she would like to share with others. The dancers stomp through the most simple steps with autistic determination. The camera operator begins in each case with a two-shot, then, like a desperado tormenting a milksop, aims his weapon at their feet and makes them dance, dance, dance. At one point, the pager, hooked to the man's elastic waistband, goes off and a scene has to be cut short. No wonder. He is one of the most sought-after ballroom dance instructors in Manila. His partner would be, too, if more men in this city were interested in learning to dance. As it is, she must scrape by earning maybe a tenth of what the male instructor pulls down, giving lessons to a small number of addled or henpecked stumblebums like Randy Waterhouse. Randy takes the red box and holds it securely between his knees with the handy stay-closed tab pointing away from him. Using both hands in unison, he carefully works his fingertips underneath the flap, trying to achieve equal pressure on each side, paying special attention to places where too much glue was laid down by the gluing machine. For a few long, tense moments, nothing at all happens, and an ignorant or impatient observer might suppose that Randy is getting nowhere. But then the entire flap pops open in an instant as the entire glue front gives way. Randy hates it when the box top gets bent, or, worst of all possible words, torn. The lower flap is merely tacked down with a couple of small glue spots, and Randy pulls it back to reveal a translucent, inflated sack. The halogen downlight, recessed in the ceiling, shines through the cloudy material of the sack to reveal gold. Everywhere the glint of gold. Randy rotates the box 90 degrees and holds it between his knees so its long axis is pointed at the television set, then grips the top of the sack and carefully parts its heat-sealed seam, which purrs as it gives way. Removal of the somewhat milky plastic barrier causes the individual nuggets of Cap'n Crunch to resolve under the halogen light with a kind of preternatural crispness and definition that makes the roof of Randy's mouth glow and throb in trepidation. On the TV, the dancing instructors have finished demonstrating the basic steps. It is almost painful to watch them doing the compulsories, because when they do, they must willfully forget everything they know about advanced ballroom dancing, and dance like persons who have suffered strokes or major brain injuries, that have wiped out not only the parts of their brain responsible for fine motor skills, but also blown every panel in the aesthetic discretion module. They must, in other words, dance the way their beginning pupils like Randy dance.